From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, the United States and China announce greenhouse gas emission reductions. The ASEAN summit begins in Myanmar, and fans of Hello Kitty flock to events in Los Angeles that mark her 40th birthday.
I think it has something to do with innocence. It has something to do with acceptance. It has something to do with joy.
It's all ahead. I'm Sarah Williams. Despite maritime human rights and cybersecurity tensions, U.S.-China relations appear to have taken a big step forward this week with bilateral announcements during and after the regional APEC summit in Beijing. They include new plans to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, a new visa policy increasing tourist and business visas from 1 to 10 years, and an information technology agreement. Today, President Barack Obama said the U.S. agreed to cut emissions by 26% to 28% by 2025. And Chinese President Xi Jinping said CO2 emissions would peak in China by about 2030. U.S. Trade Representative Ambassador Mike Froman Tuesday said the so-called ITA eliminates tariffs on high-tech products such as semiconductors and medical equipment among 54 economies, including the U.S. and China.
And to give you some idea of the importance of this agreement, the last time the WTO agreed to eliminate tariffs on IT products was in 1996, when most of the GPS technology, much of the medical equipment, software, high-tech gadgetry that we rely on in our daily lives didn't even exist. In fact, since that time, global trade in these types of high-tech products have reached $4 trillion annually, and despite that explosion of trade, the coverage of the ITA of products has never been expanded. At a time when there have been a lot of FTAs and other regional arrangements, the WTO hasn't actually cut tariffs in 17 years, and the ITA presents the first opportunity to do that.
Froman says the agreement shows China and the U.S. can work together to advance their bilateral economic agenda. He says the ITA agreement will pave the way for resumption of similar negotiations at the World Trade Organization in Geneva. China also has won support from the 21-member APEC, Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Forum, to begin negotiations toward the Free Trade Area of the Asia-Pacific, or FTAP. President Obama Tuesday indicated the U.S. push for a separate regional free accord known as the Trans-Pacific Partnership, or TPP, is part of a growing free trade movement.
The goal of an FTAP was announced in 2006, and as leaders, we've noted that many regional initiatives will contribute to the eventual realization. We see our engagement in the Trans-Pacific Partnership as a contribution towards that effort. I look forward to the day when all of our economies can be linked together in a high-standard 21st century agreement, and I think that the work and the efforts of President Xi in setting us agenda here today will help facilitate that.
Mr. Xi calls FTAP a historic step in the direction of an Asia-Pacific free trade area. Some analysts view it as a rival to the 12-member TPP, which is still undergoing an exhaustive negotiating process. Gary Huffbauer, an economist with the Washington-based Peterson Institute for International Economics, tells VOA's Victor Beatty FTAP could potentially dwarf the TPP.
It has additional countries, particularly China. That's the big boy that would be part of the free trade area of Asia and Pacific, which is not in TPP. But it would also include the Philippines. It would include Indonesia, which is an awfully big country, 280 million people. It would include Thailand, which is certainly a big country, 60, 70 million people, not part of the current talks. And then it might also include smaller countries like Laos, Cambodia, countries of that sort. So there'd be several additional countries in the party, but the big one would be China. The second big one would be Indonesia.
Well, aside from the countries involved, is it any different from TPP?
That would remain to be negotiated. I mean, TPP is pushing the frontiers in terms of disciplines on state-owned enterprises, intellectual property rules, anti-piracy rules, patent protection rules, investor protection. Now, whether FTAP Free Trade Area of Asia and Pacific would have all those features, well, that would be a subject of negotiation. And maybe some of the other countries in the FTAP party outside the TPP members really don't want that whole array of additional features.
Can these two free trade regimes live and coexist side by side?
Oh, yes, they can. There are many free trade regimes in the world. Some are deeper, some are shallower. And, you could have the shallow one next to the deep one. I happen to think the deep one would deliver a lot more benefits, but there can be, reasonable disagreement on that.
Will the rules of the road be different? In other words, will it take years like TPP has to be negotiated?
Oh, yes. FTAP would be a big thing. I mean, it would be a really big thing. I mean, after all, if FTAP came into being, that's probably north of 60% of the world economy. TPP is already in the 40 to 50% range, but you'd get China in, and it would be a huge part of the world economy. So then the question is, who's not in FTAP, not who's in FTAP?
The U.S. wasn't in TPP for a while and then was, and then basically took over the direction of the TPP negotiations. Will China take the lead in this one?
You've asked a very perceptive question. It could be. It could be. I mean, after all, China is already the biggest trading country in the world and may become even bigger if we add up the imports and the exports, and they're becoming more of a magnet for direct investment. Yes, it could be a very China-centered. I think if it gets going, the U.S. will want to jump in with both feet at some point, not during the Obama administration, perhaps, but during the next administration. So you'd have both China and the U.S. trying to steer it, in their respective directions. But if the U.S. just stayed on the sidelines, you've painted the picture.
Gary Huffbauer says China and the U.S. could soon enter a greater cooperative economic relationship with conclusion of a trade and services agreement, a bilateral trade investment pact, and a government procurement deal. He says that could dramatically change American perceptions of China as a trading partner, reduce the trade imbalance, and lower overall bilateral tensions. The 25th summit of the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, ASEAN, is underway. VOA correspondent Steve Herman reports from Myanmar's capital, Naypyidaw, that the summit opened with the host's expression of concern about unfulfilled goals.
The ASEAN summit opened with the anthem of the organization, an unfamiliar song to which few of the leaders and Southeast Asian diplomats in attendance could sing along. That reflects the current dilemma of ASEAN's 10 members. Some 48 years after its formation, the organization is still trying to define its goals and agree on harmonious policies for a diverse community of more than 600 million people. The summit's host, Myanmar's president, made note of this in his opening speech. Thein Sein cautioned that 1 year before the launch of the ASEAN Economic Community, which is supposed to create a single market, challenges remain in implementing the remaining 20% of the targets and addressing the issues that will emerge in the post-2015 ASEAN community. The president also stated ASEAN needs to play a greater role in the international arena by taking a more united stand in addressing issues of common concern and interest. That was interpreted in part as referencing the frustration among some states with the slow pace of finalizing a code of conduct for the South China Sea. The Philippines and Vietnam, in particular, have raised strong concern about maritime standoffs in the disputed waters involving Chinese vessels. The ASEAN meeting will be followed Thursday by the 9th East Asia Summit. U.S. President Barack Obama is to attend the summit, along with such other leaders as China's premier, South Korea's president, and the prime ministers of Australia, India, Japan, and Russia. Steve Herman, VOA News, at the ASEAN Summit in Naypyidaw, Myanmar.
The United Nations Refugee Agency warns it will have to cut winter aid for nearly 1 million displaced Iraqis and Syrians because of a severe funding shortage. The UNHCR says it will have to make some very difficult choices over who will receive aid this winter and who will not. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
The UN Refugee Agency warns of very tough times ahead for hundreds of thousands of people in conflict-ridden Syria and Iraq. Because of a funding shortfall of more than $58 million, the UNHCR says it will have to concentrate its efforts on helping the most vulnerable survive the harsh winter. UNHCR spokeswoman Melissa Fleming says the needs in Iraq are massive, but funding is not keeping pace with the new displacement. She says between 300 and 500 refugees are arriving daily in northern Iraq from the Kobani region of Syria.
New displacement and multiple displacement inside Syria, with people having to flee more than several times inside the country in terms of safety, has also fueled an increase in winter aid because people are fleeing without anything to protect them.
The UNHCR has added up the total number of Syrian and Iraqi refugees and internally displaced peoples and has come up with a staggering total of 13.6 million people who are displaced because of conflict and violence in these countries. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
One of Australia's biggest security operations is underway as delegates arrive for the G20 summit in Brisbane. Economic growth is expected to dominate the gathering of international leaders in the Queensland state capital. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Global growth is at the top of the agenda for this weekend's G20 meeting in Brisbane. Delegates will look at ways to raise their collective output by at least 2% above the currently projected level in the next 5 years. Officials state this would boost global income, or GDP, by more than $2 trillion and create millions of additional jobs. The summit in the Queensland state capital aims to achieve these economic goals in an ambitious and meaningful way. Professor Richard Holden from the University of New South Wales Business School believes the key to global growth is freer trade.
There's been, obviously, over the last half century or so, a huge reduction in tariff and non-tariff trade barriers across the world that's led to a huge increase in international trade that's been hugely beneficial for growth in rich countries and poor countries alike. But there are still quite a lot of trade barriers that are there, and one of the things that's key on the agenda is to talk about how to continue to make progress lowering those trade barriers.
The G20 brings together political leaders and central bank governors from 20 major economies, including Brazil, China, Japan, Russia and the United States, as well as the European Union. The grouping accounts for 85% of the world's economy and more than 75% of world trade. The gathering in Queensland is the biggest meeting of international leaders ever seen in Australia. Parts of Brisbane are in security lockdown and have become heavily fortified security areas. Activists are planning to voice their fears over a range of issues, from globalisation to poverty and climate change to gay rights. Aboriginal organisations have already marched through the city, highlighting what they've described as the unjust mistreatment of Australia's original inhabitants. Some fringe groups are circulating online a plan to spread waves of destruction during the G20 summit that runs for 2 days on November 15 and 16. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney, Australia.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's voanews.com. Online news for a changing world.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. The iconic Japanese character Hello Kitty turns 40 this year. What started out as a part of Japanese pop culture has turned into a global phenomenon. Hello Kitty's anniversary is being marked by several events in Los Angeles that fans of all ages have embraced. Elizabeth Lee has details.
From Hello Kitty pizza to Hello Kitty lip gloss in the shape of apples.
Hello Kitty is five apples tall, and she weighs three apples.
The image of the iconic character has taken over parts of Los Angeles as fans celebrate Hello Kitty's 40th birthday. That includes Annabelle Carrillo, who is wearing a large red bow on her head, just like Hello Kitty.
I'm hitting 40, and I've been with Hello Kitty since, God, I was like maybe 5 or 6.
Thousands of fans attended events to commemorate Hello Kitty's 40th anniversary. Christina Kahn persuaded her friend John Tsang to go to the convention.
It's cute. I guess my nieces really like it.
So. I'm actually amazed at how crazy people are about it, actually. Yeah. So to me, it amazes me, too.
Fans from out of town can stay at a hotel decorated with Hello Kitty art and even view a Hello Kitty room exhibited at the Line Hotel by interior designer Sean Nibb.
I think it has something to do with innocence. It has something to do with acceptance. It has something to do with joy. I mean, I think we can all relate to that no matter how old we are.
Fans also can visit the first Hello Kitty museum exhibit in North America. The president of the Japanese American National Museum, Greg Kimura, says this Japanese icon's introduction to the United States reflects a part of American history when Japanese and Asian Americans experienced prejudice.
For women of a certain generation, 40 years ago, Hello Kitty came along, and it was the first culturally Japanese image like this that they could identify with and embraced. And the early adopters were all Japanese Americans and Asian Americans.
Hello Kitty stores were first seen in Asian enclaves and eventually caught the attention of non-Asians, says the co-curator of the exhibit and Hello Kitty scholar Christine Yano in a Skype interview.
It starts there with Chinatowns, stores in Chinatowns, Japantowns, etc., but then it expands, right? And it's that marketing potential for its expansion, that's what's key. And I think that, you know, this with the flexibility of the design and this appeal to this broad range of consumership, that's what I think has been so important for Hello Kitty spread.
While working on this exhibit, Yano also discovered from the company Sanrio that Hello Kitty is not a cat. It's news that shocked fans, including Christina Kahn and John Tsang.
That's weird. I don't understand that.
Wait, she's not a cat?
She's not a cat.
What is she? Why is she a
cat? I don't know what she is. She's just not a cat.
For Annabelle Carrillo, the latest news will not change her belief for the last 40 years.
I still think she's a cat.
As a Hello Kitty scholar, Yano has her own interpretation.
Hello Kitty might be in the form, some kind of abstracted form of a cat, but that gives it a particular kind of appeal. And the spirit is certainly that of, say, a little girl.
No matter who or what she is, her face has appeared on countless products, from school supplies to kitchen and bathroom items, and even motor oil. Many fans say it's her message of happiness, friendship, and fun that appeals to people of all ages and cultures. Elizabeth Lee for VOA News, Los Angeles.
Well, cat or not, happy birthday to Hello Kitty. A free concert here in Washington broadcast around the world capped off the Veterans Day celebration in the United States. Hundreds of thousands came out for the first ever Concert for Valor, featuring such superstars as Bruce Springsteen, Rihanna, Carrie Underwood, and Eminem. The concert was aimed at raising awareness of the problems American servicemen and women face when they return home and leave the military. One disabled Vietnam War veteran says the show is the first time he ever felt honored for his service. The show climaxed a day of events across the country saluting U.S. veterans of all wars. Well, thanks very much for joining us today for International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington.
This is Today in History. On November 12, 1815, American women's rights pioneer Elizabeth Cady Stanton was born. She agitated not just for the right for women to vote, but also for the right to a higher education, a professional career, and a legal identity. On this day in 1866, Sun Yat-sen, often referred to as the father of modern China, was born. Sun became the first provisional president of the Republic of China in 1912, ending centuries of dynastic rule. In 1927, Leon Trotsky was expelled from the Soviet Communist Party, leaving Joseph Stalin in control of the Soviet Union. Trotsky was later deported and exiled to Mexico. In 1929, Academy Award-winning American actress Grace Kelly was born. She would marry Prince Rainier III of Monaco, becoming widely known as Princess Grace in 1956. In 1948, the International Military Tribunal for the Far East, known as the Tokyo War Trials, adjourned after convicting 25 of 28 Japanese civilian and military officials of war crimes committed during the Second World War. In 1954, Ellis Island, the main U.S. immigration control center located in New York Harbor, closed its doors after processing the last of the millions of immigrants that had moved through its doors since 1892. In 1980, Voyager 1, an unmanned American spacecraft, was the first to send back detailed close-up pictures of Saturn, its moons, and rings. In 1991, Indonesian forces opened fire on a crowd of student protesters in Dili, East Timor. More than 250 demonstrators were shot and killed. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
One of the prime goals of the Global Health Initiative, President Barack Obama's signature program, is to improve the quality of the lives of women and girls. And what better way to start than by reducing the number of deaths among mothers and newborns? In low- and middle-income countries, particularly in sub-Saharan Africa and South Asia, childbirth and the 48 hours around it are one of the most vulnerable times for a mother and baby. Every year, 289,000 women die in pregnancy or of pregnancy-related complications. 2.9 million newborns die, and 2.6 million babies are stillborn. That is why, 3 years ago, the U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, launched the Saving Lives at Birth, a Grand Challenge for Development initiative, a global partnership between USAID, the Government of Norway, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, the nonprofit Grand Challenges Canada, the UK's Department for International Development, and the World Bank. The initiative serves to encourage the development of creative and innovative solutions with regard to medical treatment, prevention, and technologies that have the capacity to reduce infant and maternal mortality around the time of birth. In less than 4 years, the Grand Challenge for Development has funded 81 innovations that help improve the survival chances of new mothers and their infants. In fact, the initiative is so promising that the Saving Lives at Birth partners recently announced that they aim to make a new commitment to invest up to another $50 million. Thus, over the next 5 years, the additional funding will accelerate and expand Saving Lives at Birth's investment into groundbreaking, sustainable projects that will help save the lives of pregnant women and their infants in some of the hardest-to-reach corners of the world. Saving Lives at Birth has mobilized the world's brightest thinkers, researchers, and entrepreneurs around the critical issue of maternal and newborn health, said USAID Administrator Dr. Rajiv Shah. During the next stage of this challenge, we aim to put an even greater focus on sourcing and accelerating innovations that significantly expand our reach to families around the world. Saving the lives of mothers and children, one of the best investments we can make.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.